Mark, welcome to Uncharted and Eclectic. So good to have you.
Thanks, Poya. Good to hear from you, man.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure knowing you over the last couple of years and glad to have you on the show. So, Mark,
Yeah, I'm glad you reached out.
typically how we like to start off the show is asking for people to give either their baseball card or football card, and not the specific of how tall you are or anything, but more along your of your background of where you grew up, your
How has your weight
upbringing.
changed in the last
Yeah.
24 months? Yeah, of
Yeah.
course.
More the context on like your personal as well as professional career. So let me
Sure, sure,
defer to
sure.
you and allow you to give the context to the listener.
Yeah, happy to. So I've kind of spent my career in sales roles or kind of go-to-market roles at either early stage startups or scale-up companies. Right out of undergrad, I joined what was then an early stage startup based in Utah that was selling online rent payment software to apartments because they realized that writing a check was basically the only check that anybody wrote. So they figured out a way to have online or renters pay their rent online. Company was then called Property Solutions, now called Entrata, doing really well. They've bootstrapped effectively a business up to about 1,000 people, north of 100 million in sales, are doing really well. After I left Entrata, I went back to grad school, actually moved out east, went to grad school for a year, and then joined HubSpot and really spent the bulk of my career there at HubSpot. Started as an early sales rep on the channel sales team there and grew with HubSpot through different regions, opened up their business in Europe, spent about 3 years in Europe, moved from Europe to Asia, launched their business in Asia, all while leading kind of go-to-market sales teams, and kind of reached to a point where I'd been overseas for about 7 years. And what happens with American expats overseas is that 7 years, you're either a lifer and you're there for 20 years or you come back. And so I elected to come back and looked at a few different opportunities, decided to get into an emerging space in customer success. It's a new space, it's growing, bunch of companies in the space, a lot of exciting stuff going on. And so now I run sales and marketing for client success. And we're helping customer success teams to keep and grow their customers. Is that enough of a baseball card for you?
It's the perfect amount of baseball card, absolutely.
Great.
So thanks for the context there. Let's, I guess, dive into a couple of things you brought up. So one of the things you brought up was going to grad school and only for a year and then joining HubSpot. So one thing, at least one trend I'm seeing right now as we film this, right? It's the middle of May 6th. The last 2 months, frankly, has been a little brutal. Lots of layoffs. So if
To
people
say
are
the least.
thinking about like, hey, do I continue the professional or do I go back to school? At least from your experience, what would you suggest to those folks? Like from what was your experience like?
Typically, my advice is if you kind of look, one or two steps ahead, where do your opportunities lie? If you're at a super high growth company that you're going to have a ton of really cool, unique experience over the next 2 to 3 years. For instance, if you were at, HubSpot early on or Google early on or Salesforce early on, and you're effectively going to learn all the same stuff you would learn in an MBA, stay where you're at. Where I was at, I was in a bit of a unique scenario. I felt like I kind of needed something to accelerate. Like the company I was at, I was kind of in a weird role. I was a field rep at an early stage company, and long story short, I felt like I needed kind of an external driver to accelerate my career forward. So that's why I decided to do it. And I mean, there's some people who just kind of tend to be a little bit more, I don't know, I'm a little bit more keen on education. I always kind of grew up with that. A lot of my siblings have graduate degrees. My dad has a graduate degree. And so I kind of always grew up with the idea of I was going to get a graduate degree. But I also grew up with the idea of I want to start and run a business, which is still a big part of my aspiration. So I decided to go to a school that really focused on entrepreneurship, and that's what really kind of that's what excelled me there, and it got me into HubSpot.
Yeah, 100%. And one school that's consistently ranked top of entrepreneurship, Babson. So you definitely picked wisely, and they picked wisely as well. So give us the experience about HubSpot. Looking back, you get going. How were you able to, like, what differentiated you? I think part of it, right, when you join a company that's scaling quickly, like, that's a huge benefit.
Sure. But yeah.
Why did they select you, or did you nominate yourself to basically go global with HubSpot? Like, tell us the story there.
So when you're joining these early stage companies, they've got one or two things figured out, and they've got 100 things that they haven't figured out. And so my advice to anybody when they're entering a situation like that is go find the problem that hasn't been figured out yet and go solve that, because that's what's going to make your career at a company like that.
So how did you do that, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, so when I joined HubSpot, basically I kind of looked around, and I was part of what was then an early channel sales team. So prior to me joining, there were 100% a direct model. For those who don't know, basically a direct model is traditionally what you see in enterprise B2B SaaS sales. It's, I've got a product, I'm reaching out to customers, and I'm selling it to them. And right before I had joined, a guy named Pete Caputa had started a channel, or an indirect go-to-market model, for HubSpot, which was basically, I'm going to build a network of partners and resellers. In our case, it was marketing agencies to resell our software. And so started off kind of early on that team. And that was more just kind of a luck of the draw. That was the team that was hiring at that point. So I joined with them. And what ended up happening was, the sales rep sitting next to me was the top sales rep in the company. And really what was going on there was, he was the only one who was calling international leads. It was him and a small group of folks who were calling the international leads. And really what that was just, he was waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning in Boston and getting into the office at 4 and calling into Europe. And so we both kind of looked at it, and I kind of just heard what he was doing all the time. When I was getting into the office at 9, he'd already been there for 5 hours and he already closed a couple deals. So I wish I could say it was this genius move, but a lot of it was more just kind of looking at what G2 was doing and saying, dude, I want a piece of that. But like doing that led to he and I and a few other folks really partnering together on figuring out a go-to-market business for a whole new region. We really had no presence in Europe, no presence internationally at the time. And so really that's kind of where it started, was just looking at, you know, you got one person trying to figure out how to sell internationally. And so partnered with him, and we ended up building a really nice team. We ended up getting it up to about 5 or 6 people who were selling into Europe, getting up early like we were, and we knew that wasn't going to scale. And so when it came time to launch in Europe, after looking at multiple different locations, we ultimately settled on Dublin, which turned out to be a fantastic choice. It kind of became that group that had been waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning was the logical kind of landing team. Those of us who raised our hand to go, to move to Ireland and found that business. And so everybody that was part of that group was part of the early morning team that was calling, you know, waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning. So the other thing I think a lot about, and this doesn't just go in startups, this goes in kind of any stage company, is 9 times out of 10, when I see somebody getting an opportunity, somebody getting a promotion, somebody getting, you know, the opportunity to go open up a new office, 9 times out of 10, that goes to the logical choice. Rarely do you see somebody getting a promotion, at least in the companies I've been in, and it completely comes out of left field. It's usually the person who's frankly already doing the job. And so with us going to Ireland, it was, you know, there's a small group of us that were already doing the job. So we became the landing team to go to Dublin. And so does that, I can go into way more detail on that, but that's kind of my general thoughts there.
No, it's the perfect context. So were you single at the time, or did you have to take the family as well?
I was married. My wife was pregnant with our first child. She got on the plane. We'd never been to Dublin. We always knew that we kind of thought it would be a cool idea to move overseas, but we all took a big leap. And one of my colleagues who went with us, he and his wife actually had two kids at the time. And yeah, there was a lot of family moving between Boston and Dublin and I guess that was early 2013, I guess. So yeah, yeah. That was a discussion that, you know, me and my wife had to both really be bought in on. And, you know, that was, yeah. So short answer.
No, it's so look, you were at HubSpot in 2011 to 2013, right? Still, I would say during the era where like everybody was trying to figure it out, they weren't as known as they are today, right? 10 sure. years later.
Yep.
What do you think? What are some of the first couple of things that they got right from your experience from the early days that you think were incredibly powerful in helping them have the scale and success that they've had?
What's interesting is a couple of those investments that they made early on are actually still what's paying off for them today. The first investment that they got right is the idea of thought leadership and brand building. Like Brian is a sales and marketing guy at heart. Dharmesh, who started, you know, those are the two co-founders. Dharmesh is a hacker technologist at heart. But the thing that they got right was, I mean, a year before they had a product, they started the blog.hubspot.com, and they got a bunch of marketers talking about marketing, and they generated a ton of buzz. And like still to this day, even though, you know, you see the whatever that report that I believe it's Scott Brinker reports on the marketing technology landscape and how you follow it over the last 8-10 years that he's been doing it. And early on when he published it, there was probably 30 players in enterprise marketing technology. Now there's 8,000. Even the fact that there's 8,000, you know, marketing technology players in there technically competing with one piece of the puzzle that HubSpot would do, none of them have been able to duplicate the thought leadership, the brand, from just creating a ton of really good content. And while today the content like mechanism has changed, there's not too many people that are being like, you could start a blog in 2009 and you were the only one doing it in your space. Now every company has a blog, every company has a podcast, but like, you know, the idea of creating really good content, like what you guys do at Saster, like that idea of creating really good content and generating a bunch of thought leadership and buzz around that bought HubSpot a lot of time to figure out their product. Like when I joined, it was not the HubSpot that you know today. We were facing churn problems. We were facing all sorts of internal issues. We couldn't, you know, we were falling all over ourselves. But because we had this blog that was generating, I think at the time, 30,000 inbound leads a month, that bought us a lot of time to figure out the product. And eventually the product got figured out. And that's part of what you know today. Like that, the product that you know today as HubSpot really kind of had its originations more like 2013, 2014. When kind of David Cancel and his team kind of got his hands on it, but that's a whole other story for another time.
Sure. Yeah. But look, the biggest learning I got from here, and I'm thinking real time for future entrepreneurs, founders, whoever, sometimes it's beneficial to build the audience. I didn't even know that they had built it or start creating it a year before than it is, right? Like you almost, at least I didn't learn this in business school, right? Like, hey, build the audience first, then go and find the customer or build a community. So
the biggest mistake I see so many startup founders make is they spend so much time tinkering on the product and they never figure out who they're going to sell it to. You want it backwards. You know, Apple has mastered the ability to say, hey, we're going to launch a product. You know, they'll get up on stage and they'll launch a product that they're not actually going to release for 4 months, but they're doing that to create buzz so that everyone's excited about the new gadget and they're all going to go line up outside the Apple store the morning it's launched. They don't do it backwards. They launch it, they announce it, and then figure out how to get it to you. And like, you know, if you're any startup founder entrepreneur and you have a topic, you have an audience that you want to go after, like build an audience first as best you can, and then sell to them. You get a lot more revenue a lot faster just because you got people that are willing to buy from you on day one versus trying to figure out how to build that audience after you've already spent X amount of time building a product that you're not even sure whether they want or not.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. So really good success early on, even though you guys had your ups and downs. Kudos to getting up early, calling Europe. What was the most surprising thing once you got to Dublin about selling into that audience versus even though you were selling internationally, so in theory it's not that different, but what were some of the most surprising things for you?
It really forced us to take a look at our go-to-market model in a couple surprising ways. The first thing was, and this still happens today, I see this happen all the time. You've got US tech company who's launching in Europe, launching in APAC, launching in Australia, whatever. And there's a bunch of people who will come and give the advice to say, okay, the way you do it in the US is totally not gonna work here. So you've gotta basically upend your go-to-market, upend your sales process, upend your messaging. The way that you sell in this market won't work in this market. And it really scared the heck out of us early on because we were just hearing this constantly left and right that, you know, the way that we sold in Boston to a US audience is going to be totally different than the way you would sell in Ireland to a European audience. And we kept hearing that, you know, early on before we launched, kind of in that space between we'd announced and the space between when we'd actually launched. And it really forced us to kind of just be scientific about our go-to-market. And so really what we ended up doing was we said, okay, well, if you're saying we need to blow up our go-to-market model, and we're saying, well, we've already figured out a lot of things of how to sell, let's just treat this as a science experiment and start testing different pieces. So let's go in step one with what we know, which is our traditional, let's call it North American sales process, marketing process, et cetera, and try to duplicate that one for one. And then start doing kind of A-B tests or minor tweaks off of that. And this kind of started a process for us over the course of 12, 18 months where we were selling basically the same way that we would sell. Like if you were on our sales floor in Dublin or our sales floor in Boston, we were effectively running the same process, but we were being more experimental and tweaking and trying to change a few different things while we were going probably a little bit faster than we would have been in Boston, but we were basically testing the model. And what we ended up realizing is that after kind of 18 months of testing this, there was about 85% of our selling process that turned out to be exactly the same. And there were some minor tweaks here and there that we had to make, like minor things like having to sell a little bit more in person, doing more in-person events, those types of things. And there's probably a bunch more things I could go into, but early on, it turned out that assumption that we were going to have to drastically upend our market model, that turned out to be wrong. In, let's call it those core English-speaking markets. Now, jumping into other markets like France, Spain, Germany, and in Europe, or going to Asia and trying to expand into markets like Japan, Korea, China, those are drastically different. And that's why I advise most companies expanding overseas, like don't go there first. Those are really hard fights. And they do require a much different level of investment and experimentation to get right. Like best thing to do is go to markets that are close to like what you'd see in the US. So, you know, go to markets like the UK and Ireland, Northern Europe, Benelux, Nordics. They've got money. They're comfortable working in, you know, Western terms. If you're going to APAC, that's why you see so many companies go to Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Hong Kong first, and then try to figure out the more difficult markets. But if you go in early trying to figure out the difficult markets, like I was also really good friends with the guys at Qualtrics. They actually launched in Ireland the same year that we launched. And they went in with a much more, we're going to figure out some of these other markets. They hired French reps, Spanish reps, German reps early on, and those turned out to be much more difficult markets to break into. And so they had a much slower launch, whereas we were kind of selling to the markets that we knew we could sell to, and we got a much faster launch, and that just helped us build more momentum early on.
Yeah, very good general advice across the board. I think everything you've said, I would agree to. The only thing I would add is, like, if you have a good amount of customers knocking on the door, if they're from France, Spain, and whatnot, like, pay attention to that, right?
Sure.
But at the same time, what I've seen is those companies put a huge emphasis, at least from my experience, on, like, the cultural aspect, like having someone not only speak their culture, but their language, everything.
Absolutely. Right?
So that at least has just been some of my observations. So then you go to Singapore and you start opening up the at least sales office over there. I've at least just never sold really into Asia. Like, how is that experience different, or what was unique about that? Like, what were some of the learnings for you?
Yeah, that one is very different than selling in Europe, because kind of you think about it this way, like, kind of if you kind of go with that operating mindset that I mentioned, kind of going into Europe, like, okay, start in the UK, the Benelux, the Nordics, across those markets, you've got better than kind of 100 million people that are in, you know, first world economies, comfortable working in English or transacting in English, even though English might not be their native tongue, but you can get started fast there. When you look at APAC, like, really what you have in terms of well-developed English speaking or comfortable working in English economies, you've got Australia, New Zealand. And I never really touched Australia, New Zealand. That was a separate team that went down there before I did. I was really more kind of core Asia when I was there. So everything that I mentioned kind of that relates to Dublin, you could take a lot of those learnings and apply those to Australia, New Zealand. My experience is much more in core Asia, where the challenge there is, again, if you think, you know, core English-speaking developed economies, that population shrinks quickly, right? You've got Singapore that fits that mold, 5 million people, or 5-6 million people, and then Hong Kong, which is similar enough population size, but it doesn't really expand out beyond that. You have some very, you know, wealthy developed economies, but they're, you know, their culture, their language, very different. Japan, Korea, you know, China's obviously a growing economy. And so that one, we actually, and this is pretty common, you see, we had a much slower build in those markets. And you had to be much more deliberate about kind of choosing and finding partners and resellers in given markets. So, you know, we had to figure out how to sell in a market like India, which is drastically different. You have a huge population with, you know, a ton of potential, but a very different price sensitivity, a very different negotiation mindset, and still only a much smaller addressable market in the type of people that could afford our software. And so, you know, we had to be much more deliberate, especially in, let's call it Southeast Asia, about a partner-led strategy where we would find key partners and resellers in markets like, you know, India, Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, and really allow them to pull us into markets. Japan was probably our biggest early success story in Asia. And really that came as a result that they found us. There was an early marketing agency that found us as a partner, and they were comfortable working with us in English and then working in Japanese to the rest of the market. And they really, like, pulled us into that market, doing, you know, kind of owning the go-to-market and being, for lack of a better term, HubSpot Japan, and really pulling us into that market so much so that we said, okay, you know, this partner has got, you know, 50, 60 customers that they've signed on for us. Great. Like, that's enough proof for us that we will eventually go build a small team. And that's what we did. I think we launched with, you know, 5 or 6 people in a Tokyo office, and that thing's growing. I think they've got 30 or 40 people in Tokyo now, but very different go-to-market. And there were some markets that even the 3 years that I was there, we did very little to touch. We did very little in Korea. We did very little in China. Part of the reason being culturally, knowing that it was a big investment to get early traction in Japan, and we'd have to make similar size investments in markets like Korea and China. The other thing is, and this is what some companies don't understand, is like for us in the HubSpot use case, we fundamentally sold a marketing and sales product that was built for people that use Google, use Facebook, use email marketing, and kind of optimize around kind of that marketing tech stack. But when you go into markets like China and Korea, the marketing tech stack, while the activities might be similar, the tech stack's totally different. Nobody uses email in China. Everybody's using, you know, messaging apps. Nobody uses Google. Google doesn't exist in China. Facebook, yeah, same thing. So we had a much more difficult time expanding in those markets for, you know, not only cultural reasons, but, you know, fundamentally our technology had a difficult time working. And that's something that they still really haven't figured out, even after I've been gone for a couple of years now. They still haven't really figured that part out.
Fair enough. Fair enough. We're going to, everything you've shared, I've loved, but I think the unique experience that you have now is you kind of view the world from a customer success lens now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so for sure. Yeah.
You've been successfully working with marketers, right? So the top of the funnel. Yep. You've been a sales leader, which I would say is usually the middle of the go-to-market team, right?
Yep.
Now, day-to-day, you work with the end in mind. So what would you say, since you've been at client success, what has changed for you from like a go-to-market perspective, knowing what you know now, like working with customer success leaders, which is different than what you knew before you took this role?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. Like when you grow up in kind of a sales and marketing world, which is really what I had been doing up to this point, you kind of view the world through that lens. And so jumping into customer success, while there's a ton of similarities, and I think there's actually more similarities than there are differences, like it does force you to think differently. Something that, you know, Dave Blake, my CEO, says frequently, and I think is spot on, is he talks about like kind of the mindset between a kind of a new business leader versus a kind of customer success, not even just leader, but, you know, professional. And really the way he thinks about it is a lot of sales folks tend to be either kind of achievement or money driven. And if you go to the complete other end of the spectrum, customer success leaders or customer success folks tend to be more relationship driven. Now, the fact of the matter is the best sales folks are those folks who are achievement and money driven, but can really flex over and have the ability to build good relationships. And then on the flip side, the best customer success folks are those folks who can really manage and have a good relationship with their customers, but never lose sight of the fact that, you know, this is a business. We need to make sure we're driving and owning revenue. And that's leading to a much broader discussion right now in the customer success arena around revenue ownership, around, you know, there's a school of thought of people within customer success that say customer success should never own revenue. They should be relationship thought leaders, and leave all the revenue, leave the renewal, read the cross sell, leave all the upsell, leave that to the sales team. Where there's other customer success leaders that are saying, yeah, bring me a number, help me own a number. And especially in today's climate, unfortunately, you're starting to see a lot of the folks who are in customer success, but not owning a number of some type. And that doesn't mean they need to be traditional sales people, but not owning a number. What ends up happening is they're seen much more as a cost center. And so when you have a downturn like we're in right now, you're seeing a lot of people out of work. And from what I'm seeing is a lot of those folks tend to be customer success leaders or customer success folks that didn't truly own a number. And that's something that we're really passionate about here at Client Success, is making sure that everybody knows, yep, like the best customer success folks are very relationship driven, but they still step up and own a number, because that's how they're going to get credibility with the board. that's how they're really going to drive enterprise value for the business.
And what's the number, you think, from your perspective? And I know a lot of it will depend on the business, the context, but what have you seen work? Like, I know Dave asks the community a lot of the times, like, what KPIs people should own and whatnot. Like, what do you think for sales, right? It's pretty straightforward. It's usually new revenue. What do you think it is for customer success?
It usually starts around renewal. And that's for folks who have a more kind of a traditional enterprise model where I'm selling 12, 24, you know, 36 month contracts and the renewal is a sizable event. Usually kind of the renewal is kind of the first one. And then you're right, it really does depend on your model, but just kind of a few kind of guardrails to think about. If your team has traditionally with very enterprise sales, so let's say we're selling $250,000, $500,000, $1 million contracts, and really our go-to-market is less I have an account manager, more I have an account team. What you see is, that's where you see customer success owning perhaps the renewal or kind of owning more of kind of quarterbacking the relationship. So they're bringing in negotiators when they need to, they bring in product experts in when they need to, et cetera. But when it's a smaller sales cycle or a smaller deal size, let's say I'm selling, you know, average sale price of $10,000, kind of in and around that range, that's where I see a lot of examples of customer success owning everything, post-sale, everything post-sale. So whether that's renewal, whether that's upsell, whether that's cross-sell. And we were trying to figure this out a lot of the time I was at HubSpot, is who should own the upsell and the cross-sell. And so other examples of kind of owning a number could be, in some cases, it could be owning an upsell or a cross-sell number. In a lot of cases, it's owning a lead gen number. It's owning, I got to generate a certain amount of customer success qualified leads back to, a growth team or back to a sales team. So that's something that is not, I think over the next few years, you're going to see that formulated a lot more in different businesses, but that's something you talk to five different companies, you get five different answers on what the number is that success should own. And today it's a little bit all over the map right now, but I think you'll see some consolidation in that around the next few years.
Interesting. This is a super tactical question, but I've always wanted to ask it is, and you have the perspective of HubSpot as well as client success. Look, one of the things that I think HubSpot does, and I don't know if this is true or not, they don't want the CSM to be the one negotiating the dollar amount. I could be wrong, but at least that's been my experience from a buyer's perspective, right?
Yep.
And so what's your take on that? Like, what do you think is a good practice? Like, do you think the person that owns the relationship should also be the one negotiating the dollar and cents? Or like, do you think that it should be a good cop, bad cop? What's your stance?
Yeah, I think, so I'm going to step on some toes with my friends at HubSpot. Right now, kind of, they have a model and some people have a renewal specialist role that is separate from their customer success role. As a customer of that doesn't lead to a great experience for me, frankly, because I know this renewal specialist person is going to show up every 11 months and I haven't talked to this person. They don't know anything about me or about my business. They're just going to show up and negotiate a deal and then move on to 10 others. And while that might make sense internally within the business, because that person might be a better negotiator, et cetera, it doesn't lead to a great experience for me. So what I would prefer is, you know, kind of back to that mindset of the best customer success folks are people that can own a relationship, but flex and actually talk numbers. I want to train my customer success team and I want to bring in revenue-minded customer success folks who are willing to have more of a revenue discussion, have a negotiation with me. Because we know each other, we work together and, you know, we're more apt to have, like, the reason negotiators get a bad mindset is because, you know, there's frankly bad negotiators out there. Right. So my preference would be you have customer success owning that renewal number and getting trained and equipped on how to properly do it. versus having a separate renewal team that does it. That's my opinion on it, but there's plenty of folks out there that'll disagree with me on that.
No, fair enough. Fair enough. I have a two-part question since you brought that up. One is, so in those circumstances, what have you seen be like? So, like, what are some ways you've seen organizations that have done this well align their whole go-to-market team, right? Now that you have the benefit of like, especially if you're selling a subscription, it doesn't really matter if you've only sold it for 1 year, if they don't renew, right? Like it's almost like a wash, if anything, right? If it's not automatic, like in order to scale, right? That renewal almost has to become automatic year after year for the dollars sure. and the cents to make sense. Yeah. So from your experience, like what do you think some of the best teams that might frankly like not have the best product, right? Yep. That they do well in aligning the go-to-market teams?
I think that there's a bunch of things you could dig into on this, but I think fundamentally the most important decision a management, a leadership team can make is aligning the incentives of the go-to-market team. And so if you have cases where the incentives of the sales team are drastically different than the customer success team, or the incentives of the marketing team are drastically different than the sales team, then that's where you see a huge amount of conflict. Now, the best companies, the best teams are those that have figured out a way to align everyone's incentives. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody owns the same number, but it might mean that everybody owns a portion of like overlapping numbers. So for instance, like if you're on a sales team and you're trying to align the incentives between your sales team and your customer success team, and fundamentally you want your customer success team focused on account growth, you want your sales team focused on net new logos, you might think about making sure that, you know, some portion of your sales team's compensation is based on making sure that that account sticks around and grows for a long time. So if you have a very hunting compensation plan that just incentivizes net new logo acquisition and sales reps then move on to the next one, you tend to see cases where a sales rep's going to sign on a bad fit customer that's not going to stick around for a long time, but they're going to work their comp plan. And so they figured out how to, you know, get a deal done, and regardless of whether it's a really good fit for the company long term, if they can figure out how to do it, they'll do it that way. Now, the same hand, your customer success team, they've got to have some ability to influence. Obviously, they're going to be focused on long term, you know, acquisition or sorry, long term growth, renewal, cross sell, upsell. But you should also think about how do you incentivize your customer success team to work with the sales team. You know, how do those two work together? So that to me is the big thing, is just making sure that you've got a clever way to align incentives among all those groups, because that's where I see the biggest conflicts. So really the only times I can even think of my time at HubSpot or in a lot of cases where I had arguments where with colleagues in other departments, whether it was I was on the sales team and having an argument with someone in customer success or something else, it really came down to our incentives were not aligned. And they're working their plan, I'm working my plan, and frankly, we're in a lot of cases not doing what's in the best interest of the customer. And we were more a victim of the plan that had been handed down to us. So that's my thought there.
I love it. Love it. Follow-up question just for the now, right? A lot of people might be thinking this. Look, I've had a couple of customer success leaders, and the question I love to ask is, what do you think people should be doing now, like getting in front of their customers, like from a best practice perspective, right? Everybody knows, I think, about QBRs, where you meet once a quarter and review the business achievements, results that you've had, right? Measuring outcomes of like, what does the customer want you to drive to? Like, those are things I think that everybody knows. What are like some surprising, uncommon practices have you seen from your clients or customers of like, whether it's now or later, of how they're driving value for their customers?
Yeah. I mean, focus your, make sure that every time you reach out to someone, it's going to be something that's helpful to them. I see so many people run the QBR, the EBR, the review process, whatever. And it's a box ticking exercise that I got to run because that's what my manager told me I should do. But I show up to the QBR, and me as the customer, I see a bunch of stats. I see a bunch of things that maybe the vendor did, but I'm not getting a ton out of it. I'm not getting advice on, like in a QBR, I should be able to go into this as a customer and say, okay, the vendor is doing this QBR with me. And not only is it, it's some review of what happened, but it's here's five pieces of advice that we would recommend you action based on our interaction with other customers. Like our most successful customers, not just because they're successful with me, but because they're successful at growing their company or whatever the metric is that you care about driving with your platform. It's just the best folks are focused on making sure that every time we interact, you walk away from it getting something out of it. It's not, I did a QBR for QBR's sake. It's not, I'm reaching out to check in because, we got a renewal coming up in 90 days and my playbook says we need to have a conversation 90 days out. Like that's where you see challenges in the relationship. That's where you see people getting frustrated with their customer success folks is because, okay, dude's just calling me to have a check-in call. Like I hate the idea of a check-in call except for one scenario. Like everyone gets a pass on a check-in call in the last 6 weeks because everyone's world has been turned upside down. And sometimes you just need, like this is a time where it's okay to do a check-in call. Because everybody's world turned upside down and, this might be a time to have a conversation with somebody that's not business related. I've gotten on the phone with some of our customers. We have a 30-minute chat just around, work from home life or what's going on. And I think right now is the time where you get a little bit of a pass on a check-in call. But, once this is passed, you make sure you're bringing some hardcore value every time you talk to your customers. Otherwise, you're going to have a really tough time getting a hold of them. And that's going to have all sorts of bad downstream impacts.
All set. Well communicated. Well, Mark, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. It's been very fun. Before we say our goodbyes, we actually have what we call a fireaway round where I ask you a quick question and you repeat. So let's start. What do you think is one truth that from your opinion is true, but other people might not agree with you on? What's that one thing? It could be professional, personal, it could be anything.
The one truth is that, how do I want to phrase this? It's around management and everyone kind of has this mindset that in order to progress in your career, I got to move into management. I got to move into leadership. That is something that is common across our culture, that is common across our industry. People come to me all the time, Mark, I've been in my role for X period of time and I'm not managing anyone yet. What's wrong? I need to figure out how I want to get into management. And I'd say in a lot of cases, that is a terrible move because a manager is a fundamentally different type of responsibility than what somebody might do as an individual contributor. And some of the biggest mistakes that I see made are people that move into a leadership position because they want the title, but they don't actually want to develop, motivate, train teams, and are not ready to let their own star dwindle without kind of putting their team forward. Because when you move into a manager position, it's all about the team. It's no longer about you, right? I'm watching, like everybody is, I'm watching the Jordan series that's going on every Sunday night on ESPN right now. And that series is about Jordan. It's not about Phil Jackson, right? He had to make a deliberate choice to move to the background. And I think that's something that a lot of people need to think hard about. And whenever somebody comes to me and asks Mark, like, how do I get into a leadership role? Like, you've led teams at different companies, you've done all this. 9 times out of 10, my conversation is, why the heck do you want to be in management? And half the time I end up finding myself talking people out of it, because it's not right for them, might not be right for them right now, might not be right for them forever. But that's the first thing that came to mind. Is that it?
It's excellent.
Does that work?
And what you bring up, I'm laughing and giggling because I've been through it. I've learned the hard way, and you usually learn the hard way having gone through it, right? So excellent advice. I'm not saying people shouldn't do it, but I think they need to know what they're getting themselves into, because the motivations, the mindset, everything completely changes. So
like if you're in that boat, if you're the individual contributor and you're thinking about doing it, sit down with somebody who manages a team and say, walk me through your calendar this week. And you will fundamentally see a different calendar than you had as, whether I'm a sales rep, whether I'm a CSM, whether I'm this, like the stuff that I do every day as a leader is fundamentally different than as an individual contributor. And 9 times out of 10, people don't realize that until the day after they got the promotion.
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. Or at least once they've been in the role, which at least for me, I learned the hard way. What do you wish you had known when you started out? You can take that however, whether it's a client success, HubSpot, your career. Like, what's that one thing that you'd wish?
This is going to sound a little bit, it took me a while to realize this, but like when I started out in software, I started out in tech, and you still hear this a lot today. And I think there's probably plenty of people out there that will disagree with me on, there's this pressure to, and for plenty of people, this is the right move, but for a lot of people, this is not the right move, to learn how to code, to go to a coding boot camp, to go to code school, to do this. Even like, if you want to be in software, you got to learn how to make the software. And for a lot of people, totally the right move. And for me, there was a lot of time kind of early on in my career where I was kind of hearing this, and I was like, I was in a sales role, I was in a go-to-market role, but I kept kind of getting pulled toward, well, you should learn how to code. You should learn how to kind of, you should learn that side of the business. And it took me a while, and the right answer for me has been actually not to go down and learn like how to be a developer, how to be a product manager. The right answer for me, and I think for a lot of people out there, is to like take the thing that you're good at and figure out how to be the best in the world at that. So like my decision has been, actually, I'm not gonna go to a code boot camp. I'm not gonna go do this. I learned enough there just so that I can have an intelligent conversation, but I spend 90% of my time figuring out how to be a better go-to-market leader. And knowing that, you know, if I'm the best go-to-market leader, my job then is to partner with the best product engineer, that side of the house. But that's never going to be my expertise. And so purposefully, I've said, look, I'm going to lean much more into how to build great sales teams, how to build great marketing teams, how to build great customer success teams, and then partner with folks that are really good on the product side, because I could bring much more value, and a lot of people bring much more value being experts than being mediocre at a bunch of stuff.
Yeah. Know yourself and be aware of where your strengths are and double down on them. So look, Mark, this has been an excellent episode. I can't thank you enough for the time, the advice, the context you've given. So thank you. And I really hope we could see each other sooner rather than later, but thanks for joining us.
Yeah. Hope so. All right. Thanks, man.
Bye.
Talk soon. Thanks, everybody.
Engineers and engineering managers become great leaders. And how do they do that? Well, Plato helps you find the perfect mentor thanks to its network of experienced engineering leaders who work at the world's best tech companies. For a monthly fee, you have unlimited access to mentors who can help when you have challenging situations as a manager. Visit them at platohq.com.